Today is Tuesday, August 20th, 2024. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Lewis Hudgin. Lewis spells his last name H-U-D-G-I-N, first name L-O-U-I-S. My name is Tom Martin. Good evening, Lewis. How are you today?
Good evening. I'm great. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. Lewis, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do have my permission.
Thank you. We ended up part one in 1939, 40, 41-ish, when your father's brother, Alfred, had really taken to aviation and had started an aviation business. Was that called Hudgin Air Service?
Yeah, there was a bunch of different iterations of that, but
okay.
that was the main one that we used. There was Hudgin Aerotech and, I don't know, this, that, and the other thing.
Okay. But in
but
some...
It always had Hudgin in the name of it.
Sometime in the late 30s, early 40s, they had set up what you had called a full-service FBO.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
So FBO stands for Fixed-Based Operation.
Okay.
And that term came about because in the early days of aviation, there was a lot of what they called barnstormers. And I was just today watching the news, and now the modern politicians today call themselves barnstormers as they travel about the country trying to gather votes. And that's basically what the aviation barnstormers, the pioneer, the real barnstormers did, is they just travel around the country trying to sell airplane rides, and that was how they made their living.
Okay.
And so as the world progressed and moved away from the war, people started actually using aviation as a tool instead of a toy.
Okay.
And so they would want to go from here to there, but they didn't want to fly with a barnstormer because you couldn't rely on him being there all the time. So that's why the FBOs gave themselves that name, Fixed Base, because we're always going to be here.
Okay. All right. And so that makes sense. If there's a town with an FBO and I buy a plane, for whatever reason, there's going to be a store to service it and to provide parts and help me out if I got any questions, I suppose. And it's like 9 to 5. There it is.
Yep.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay. So not quite the fly-by-night of a barnstormer.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then they had that set up. As the war ended, then 45, this kind of gets into where your dad met your mom. Did your dad serve? Now, he was much older than, Alfred was much older than your dad.
Yes.
And your dad served, you mentioned about your dad's service last time. Was Alfred in the war at all?
Well, he worked for Consolidated Aircraft. And Consolidated Aircraft built war airplanes, like the B-24.
Okay.
They built the B-24s, and they built the Consolidated PBYs, which was an amphibious airplane. It had wheels on it so it could land on the ground, and it was also a flying boat so it could land out in the ocean.
Okay.
And they used those for search and rescue and for patrolling and reconnaissance and that kind of stuff.
So was he flying those, or was he helping build them? Was he at a factory somewhere? What was he doing?
Well, there was a finishing plant in Tucson.
Oh.
And he worked there as a test pilot.
Okay.
And so he was back and forth from San Diego, where the main factory was, and he'd pick up a new airplane over there and fly it to Tucson to be finished.
Okay.
Because, you know, there's all these different models. You know, there's the B-24, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and all this stuff. And they're all configured and equipped slightly different from the other. So that's why the factory didn't do that. That's a little more tedious, time-consuming. So they had finishing plants take care of those items. And that's still the way the aviation world works today.
Really?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think of Boeing. I know nothing about aircraft manufacturing, of course, so let's put that out first. I think of Boeing. I think, okay, if I want to buy a passenger jet, some 737 or 47, something like that, I go to Boeing and say, yeah, I want one of these things. So they assemble it, and then they would send it to another company, like, to get it painted or stuff?
Well, I'm not sure about Boeing itself. I think Boeing does finish their airplanes to the customer's requirements.
Okay.
Because there's not that much differences to them.
Okay.
I'm thinking more in lines of smaller airplanes like Learjet and Citation and Cessna Citation and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Smaller airplanes.
All right.
Where there's just a lot more options. But in the airline world, there's probably fewer options.
Hmm. Okay. Well, all right. So just thinking about the B-24s, and you mentioned the ABCD, et cetera. So these were finished in Tucson.
Yeah.
And then they were flown on to where they were going.
Right.
Okay. And Consolidated, I don't know that I've heard of that company. Who was that McDonnell Douglas, or who was doing that?
No, that was their own company. It was a competing company to McDonnell Douglas.
Okay.
So it's just like the automobile industry in the U.S., way back then, you know, there was a whole lot more than the big three.
Got it.
There was probably 20 or 30 car manufacturers, and there was a lot of airplane manufacturers as well.
Okay.
There was Ryan, and I believe Consolidated and Ryan merged together because they're both in San Diego.
Okay. All right. And while that was going on, while he was working for Consolidated, did the FBO, the fixed base operation, was that closed down or was it still open?
Yeah, pretty much. During the war, the little airplane companies pretty much went away.
Okay. All right. So, but Alfred would have been kind of set and ready, if you will, to open right back up at the end of the war.
Yeah. Yeah. So his airplanes were sitting in a hangar, like, across the street from Consolidated.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So all he had to do was walk across the street, as if you will, and open up shop.
Yeah.
Okay. And then when your dad came back from the service, you mentioned he started teaching, flight instructor, and that's where he met your mom.
Yes.
You mentioned just before we started this interview that you have your mother's logbook.
Yes, I do.
Can you read for us the first entry there?
I can, and I learned something today as I opened this up, because I never really paid attention to it before, but their first flight was, you know what? It wasn't him. So now I'm still reading it. Anyway, her first flight was on February 10th, 1946.
Okay.
And that's my dad's birthday.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and also my brother, Doug's birthday. They shared a birthday.
How cool is that?
So I see here where she had three flights with other people besides Dad. So Dad took over on on April 14th, 46 was his and her first flight together.
Okay.
And then
let's hang on a second to February 10th. What else does it say about that February 10th, 46 flight? Anything? How long it was or where they went, what they did?
Yeah, it says it took them, they were flying for 50 minutes.
Okay.
And it was in November, Charlie, 27619, which is a 65-horsepower Taylor craft.
Okay.
And it was called Observation. That was the object of flight, was Observation. So she was a CAP cadet. And so this is just like right after the war. And so nobody really is believing that the war is over. So they're still out there looking around for bad guys.
Okay.
And they went from Rieto to Ryan in return.
Okay, so Ryan Airfield was what we talked about this last time. One of the military bases, and this was southwest of Tucson, on the west side of the Tucson Mountains.
Yes.
And Rieto was, would that be the freeway airport, the Gilpin Airport, or was that another strip altogether?
Yeah, there's a notation here that says from and to. And they said it from Tucson, and in parentheses, it was Gilpin.
Ah.
And then it says Rieto to Ryan, and I'm sure that's just where their observing was.
Got it.
So
okay.
This Continental 65-horsepower Taylor craft is a pretty slow airplane. So, it took them a while to make that circle.
Okay.
So, well, 50 minutes.
You could almost drive that far. Well, I don't know. It'd be tough to drive all the way out to Ryan Field and back to the freeway airport. I don't know. They did all right. Huh.
Yeah, so, the Taylor craft is fairly slow, although it's faster than the Piper. They were like 85, 90 miles an hour, where the Piper was about 75, 80 miles an hour.
That's pretty good.
But you got to remember the roads back then in 1946 were all dirt.
Oh, you got a good point.
So,
yep, that's
so
right.
So you get in your pre-war Ford,
right,
and you're only going to be going 25, 30 miles an hour out there. So it's going to take you a whole lot more than 50 minutes.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Fun. So that was her first flight. Very, very good. And you mentioned that she, so February, March, April, she kept it up. Huh. She flew three more times then before flying with your dad?
Well, two more times. So she flew three times total before flying with Dad.
Okay, sort of on a every third week basis kind of thing.
Yeah, huh. She flew on March 3 and then March 29 and then April 14 with Dad.
Cool. So your mom talked about flying up to the Grand Canyon with your dad, their first date. Does she have that in her logbook?
I don't think so. This was just kind of her CAP logbook, and it only goes to August of 46. And then she got another logbook, which I do not have.
Okay. Cool. Well, at least you've got that one.
Yeah.
Nice.
Oh, well, wait a minute. Here it is. They went up to Grand Canyon in an air coupe on April 30th, 1946.
Oh, cool. April 30th, 1946. What's an air coupe?
It's a little two-seat airplane, low wing. It has a cabin around it, so you can close it in.
Okay.
And it's kind of a modern airplane in that it has a nose wheel on it.
Oh, okay.
And most airplanes back in those old days all had tail wheels.
Okay. So it's tricycle gear.
Yes.
Which
and
is...
Actually, my first airplane was an air coupe.
Okay. Was it that?
So
was it that plane?
Before I owned a car.
Was it that plane? That same plane?
No.
Okay. April 30th, 1946. How fun is that? Excellent. Oh, that's. Does it have any other notes in there at all about that flight?
Looks like they left at 8:10 and got up there at 16:45. Which they didn't have enough gas for that. So I'm. Total of this, I don't really understand what they're trying to say here.
Okay.
But it gives the N number of the airplane as 87427, November Charlie, 87427. And it had a Continental, maybe 75 horsepower engine.
Okay. And that would have been air-cooled?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, okay. So they're abbreviating things here. It says TV Mune number 2. So I think that means Tucson Municipal number 2 to Grand Canyon.
Would number 2 be the number 2 runway?
Those are nomenclature that I'm not familiar with.
Okay.
TV number 2 probably means Tucson Municipal, like maybe that's a freeway airport or the Gilpin Airport.
Oh, okay. Fun. Well, that was neat that that's in there.
Yeah.
Very cool. So in the 40s, now the war is over, 45, 46. You're born in 1952. When did your folks get married?
Probably the late 40s.
Okay. And during that time, from 45 to when you were born, 52, was your dad working for Al then?
Yeah.
And your father's brother, Palin, were they both working for Al?
Yeah, all three of them working together.
Okay. And were you born in Tucson?
What's that?
Were you born in Tucson?
Yes.
Okay. At St. Mary's?
Yep.
Okay.
Back in the old days, it was either St. Mary's or in your house.
Yeah, I shouldn't laugh, because indeed, that's what it was. Back in early 50s, it was not unusual.
Yeah. Pretty small town back then.
But by 1952, Al had already gotten swept up in the Grand Canyon business.
Yeah.
Can you kind of talk about how he made that transition from Tucson to the Grand Canyon?
Well, it wasn't really a transition. It was they ran both of them together at the same time. So it was just like an extension of the business.
Okay. Well, that makes me wonder about staffing, because when you do that, unless you shut down one place for the winter and move to the other, or you shut down the one place for the summer and move to the other, you've got to staff up there.
Yes.
To have people at both places.
Yeah. So basically the family moved back and forth to the canyon and back. So Alfred Palin and Henry, my dad, they went back and forth from Tucson to Grand Canyon. And then they used hired pilots or whoever to maintain the Tucson operation while we were up the canyon.
Okay. That makes sense.
So the Grand Canyon was kind of a summer resort.
Okay.
You've been in Arizona long enough to know that Tucson and Phoenix gets stinking hot in the summertime.
You bet.
And back in the old days, pre-air condition, everybody had two homes. They had a summer home and a winter home. Well,
okay.
That was our summer home up there, just to stay cool.
Yeah, up at 7,000 feet, that's a big deal.
Yes, it was.
I remember your mom had mentioned that she would have to wait. The guys would go up there as the business started picking up, and she would have to wait until school was out, and then she'd take a couple of days to drive up there with you and your elder brother.
Doug.
Doug, now are you the middle brother or were you the youngest?
No, I'm the middle one.
Okay. And then?
Yeah, in the early days, the roads were poor.
Okay.
And so it would take a couple days to get up there. But then, toward the end of our time up there, the roads were much better and we could do it in one night.
Okay.
So what she would do is she would wait in the school parking lot until they let school out for the summer, and we'd walk out of the school into the car and off we'd go.
Oh, wow.
And you know, we would drive all night long, and then we'd get there sometime in the middle of the night or super early in the morning. And then we'd get up and go to work as soon as the sun got up.
Okay.
So we worked all summer long.
So what are some of your earliest memories of life? Let's start life in Tucson first, and then we'll go to earliest memories, life at Grand Canyon.
Okay. I don't know. What are you getting at here?
Well, one of the things that I remembered your elder brother Doug talking about was one of the things that they had you guys doing there was throwing rocks off the runway. But I'm thinking
yeah.
In Tucson that wasn't a deal because they have no rocks to throw off the runway there. Do you have any early memories of family in Tucson? And,
the whole family was there, not the whole family, but most of the family was there in Tucson. So we had a lot of aunts and uncles and cousins and all that.
Fun.
And then the airport, we lived on the east side of the airport, and the hangar was on the west side of the airport. So it was quite a distance to drive from our house to the hangar. So as little kids, we didn't go there a whole lot. But when we did go to the hangar, it was usually for short periods because, you know, Dad's a pilot and Mom wouldn't usually stay there.
Okay.
And so, you know, there was nobody to keep us out of propellers and grease and stuff like that.
Okay.
So if Dad was fairly confident that he could go to work and not go on a flight someplace, then he might take us with him, and we'd spend the day or half of the day, just screwing around or wiping bellies, we called it, because the old airplanes, they would leak a little bit of oil, and it would get on the belly, and then even though the runways at Tucson were paved, there was still a lot of dust. And so they'd get all dirty, and it was a kid's job to wipe the bellies.
Okay.
And clean them up.
And just with a rag soaked in gasoline or?
No, just a dry rag, and we just wipe it. It was mostly just oily dirt.
Okay.
And then Alfred, he was always, a car collector. He liked cool cars.
Okay.
And so he had a bunch of cool cars out there, and I know for myself, I was always interested in those weird cars, and he'd usually give us a ride in one or more of them, and that was just a lot of fun for me.
What kind of cars? What do you remember about those?
Well, the one in particular was a three-wheel Morgan from England that was built in the 30s.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's three wheels, and it's a right-hand drive.
Okay.
And it had a two-cylinder engine like a Harley-Davidson, a V-twin.
Huh.
And it sat in the front of the car outside, so you could see the whole engine. It was not under a hood or a bonnet or whatever. And it had the exhaust pipes. It didn't have any doors. You had to crawl over the sides of it to get in it. It was just a lot of fun.
Hey, that V engine. Now, when I think of a Harley, there's a forward cylinder and a back cylinder, and those two cylinders are in line with the direction of traffic.
Right. So on the Morgan, it was the other way.
They were crosswise, the direction of traffic.
Yes.
Huh. Okay. Well, that sounds like quite the machine.
So it was actually Uncle Al that got me into little cars.
Okay.
I told you earlier that I was writing a newsletter, and that's for a little car club that basically I put together. Laurel and I have been putting a car show on for the last 44 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And it started with that Morgan that I just described.
Huh.
As a very little kid.
How cool is that? What do you remember about your Uncle Al?
Well, lots. He was, like you mentioned in your text, he was a fun guy.
And did he have any kids?
He did. He had one kid, Alfred, they called him Little Al. Yeah, but he was killed in an accident on a motorcycle and a horse. When he was 16 years old.
Oh.
Yeah, so I actually never met him.
Okay.
But years later, I met the guy who was on the motorcycle with him when he died.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did you ask him about the accident?
Oh, yeah. He was very familiar with it, remembered it all, and it kind of messed up his life, and it messed up Alfred's wife's life, Aunt Mary.
I bet.
Yeah, and she really never recovered.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, so their life, it changed after that.
They were both on the motorcycle, and they hit a horse?
Yeah, they were kind of in a back lot and just screwing around like kids tend to do, you know,
Yeah. Kicking
up dust and spinning around in circles, and you know what they do on motorcycles and stuff, just like they do today. And I don't know the whole story, and maybe what I've remembered is all screwball, but a horse got loose from its corral or owner or whatever, and it was just running loose, and it came through the alley as the boys were coming out of the alley, and they hit each other. And
oh, wow.
And Alfred was killed, and I think the horse was killed also.
Wow. Okay. tragic there, boy.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would have been 1950-ish?
Probably around there, late 40s, early 50s.
Okay. All right. Okay, so that was Tucson, you know, working on the clean the bellies of the planes and you know, hang out, don't get too much underfoot. Let's then go up to Grand Canyon. What were some of your earliest memories of and this is the Grand Canyon Airport at Red Butte, and this would be in the early mid 50s.
Yeah, I think they took on the Grand Canyon Airlines either in 49 or 50.
Okay.
And they ran it till about 69.
Okay. And so what are your memories, your early memories of the Grand Canyon? Your mom would pick you up right out of school, and you get in a car, and then, you know, eventually fall asleep, I'm sure, and wake up.
Drive all night, and we'd wake up in the morning, and we're there.
Okay.
And then I learned to drive when I was 9 years old.
Okay.
In a Morris Minor that was one of the airport cars. And I kept that car. I still have it today. So we had that. We had a model AA, a 1929 model AA, and just all kinds of, you know, just airport vehicles.
Okay.
You know, pickup trucks and tractors and just, you know, stuff that you need to maintain an airport.
All right.
So I learned to drive, like I said, when I was 9. And Dad taught me how to drive in the shift gears. You know, they're all manual transmissions. And he gave me 2 weeks to practice, just play around on my own in that Morris and the Model A and the tractor. So I drove everything, just getting used to them. And then 2 weeks later, he put me to work.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, doing what?
So I was gassing airplanes.
Okay.
So we had it wasn't a gas truck, it was a gas trailer.
Okay.
And I'm guessing it was about 1,000 gallons.
All right.
And we towed it with that international harvester tractor, farm tractor, you know, which is a pretty big machine for a little 9-year-old kid.
Right.
And then it had had two sections, two different fuels in it. It had 100, 130, and 80, 87 octane fuels in it. And so it had two sections or two compartments, which each had their own pump. And the pump was a gas engine like on your lawnmower.
Okay.
And so you had to pull a rope and start the engine. Well, the engine and the rope was higher, it was taller than I was.
Oh, well,
so
right.
I couldn't pull it and get the engine started. So what I had to do was I had to climb up on the trailer. It was like a bumper back there. I'd get up on that bumper and I'd grab that rope and I'd jump off.
Cool.
So my weight was enough to get the engine started.
Wow.
And so then I'd gas the airplanes and ride it all down and all that stuff and then go off and do the next one.
Huh. Let's talk about this the International Harvester tractor. When you say tractor, I think of some giant rubber-tired back-wheeled thing and a small rubber-tired front-wheel thing.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Okay. All right.
It's just like a farm tractor that, you know, every farm in the Midwest has.
Okay. All right. So that wouldn't have torn up the runway or the taxi area where the planes were.
No. Uh-uh.
Okay. And
there was a lot of activity in the ramp area in front of the hangars and where they parked the visiting airplanes and all that was, you know, it was soft, but it wasn't powdery.
Okay.
Because there wasn't that much activity. So, you know, it was a little bit dusty, but not horrible.
Okay.
And then it rained often enough up there to keep the dust down.
Now, that airport is in a, I almost think of a playa. I mean, there's a lot of black brush there, sage brush.
Yeah.
But it's this kind of big playa thing, and in a heavy rain, would it fill up, kind of fill full of water?
Only one time when we were up there did we flood to where we couldn't use the airport. But actually that runway was the longest dirt runway in the entire world.
Okay.
It was over 10,000 feet long. So 2 miles of dirt runway.
Wow.
Yeah. So even if there was a big rain and there was a mild flood, you know, like back in the far north corner of the airport or something.
Okay.
And we had three different runways. So we just use another runway, or we just use the other end of the runway or something.
Yeah.
You know, or
okay.
shorten our takeoff run. So we're always able to you know, utilize what was left.
All right.
But this one particular year, we got a huge, huge rain, and it just flooded that whole north end of the airport.
Okay. Where the hangar and the housing was?
No, farther north than that.
Oh. So you mentioned three runways. Can you tell me the layout of those runways, kind of their orientation to north, south, east, west, and...
The main runway was 03 and 21, which is 30 degrees and 210 degrees. And then there was another one that was almost parallel to that, and it was only a few degrees different.
Okay.
And then there was a third one, which we called the crosswind runway, and it went... Well, I don't know what heading it was, but it was pretty short, and we didn't use it very often unless the wind was just absolutely blowing, howling,
okay,
you know, real hard.
And I think of crosswind to the 03 and 21. That Crossways Airport, was that kind of pointing at Red Butte?
No, the 3 and 2-1 was pointed at Red Butte.
Okay.
So the new airport uses the same heading on their runway, 3 and 2-1.
Oh, okay.
So that's the predominant wind up there.
Okay. And it's funny because when I think about that, that's almost, well... not quite north-south, but sort of in that general trend.
Yes, yes. It's real close to north-south.
Okay. Huh, because when I think about the Red Butte, I think east-west. That's funny, it's north-south. Okay.
Yeah, it's south of the airport.
Okay.
Just a little bit. So, and that was always an issue, and that was one of the justifications for moving the new airport to its current location, is to get away from that mountain.
Oh. All right.
We never did have anybody hit the mountain, but it was quite often an issue, you know.
Okay.
You're going to have to do something pretty quick to get away from it.
Like turn.
Yeah, or climb or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, okay, all right.
Yeah.
And then
if the wind was blowing a crosswind,
right,
like say from the west, you would want to go around the mountain to the west to get the upflow from the lift from the wind.
Okay.
And if you went to the left, you would be on the lee side of the mountain, and you would get sink
into its rotor.
We were always very cautious to let the lowlanders know about the problems with that mountain.
Okay. So if you took off in
turn right.
In the 21, turn right.
Yeah, turn right.
Okay.
Which was not natural because the ground was in a rising situation there to the right and lowering to the left. So it looked like you'd be better off going to the left until you understood that you were on the lee side of the mountain and you're in the sink side of the mountain instead of the lift side of the mountain.
Okay. So when you were, when you had the tractor turned over to you with the 1,000-gallon tank on the trailer, how many planes would you gas up in a day?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Maybe 10.
Okay. Well, so what?
Yeah. So, you know, it's high elevation. It's not quite the 7,000 you mentioned. It's 6,600.
Okay.
But then when you throw in 85, 90, 95 degrees, you know, the density altitude is like 10,000 feet. So the airplanes are struggling because very, very few airplanes had turbocharging back then. So they were just normally aspirated engines.
Got it.
At 10,000 feet. So, you know, it's 3% per 1,000 feet that you're losing.
Mm.
So when you start out with marginal horsepower to begin with, and then you multiply it by or subtract 30% from it, well, you know, you're struggling.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So we would not put a full load of fuel in it. We'd only put a few gallons in, just enough for the flight. So we would gas the airplanes often after they got back, even though they were short flights, you know, like 25 minutes, 35 minutes, 45 minutes, we would always just regas them.
Okay. But not full, not running full.
No.
Okay.
Just enough for the next flight and a little reserve.
All right. You know, I didn't ask your mom or Doug. We talked quite a bit about the 1956 air crash. I didn't ask them about any other air crashes out there during the 50s. Do you remember any other plane wrecks out there?
Yeah, there was two of them while we were there. There was a Cessna 170 that took off downwind to the north instead of taking off into the wind to the south. And he was heavy and he, you know, had too many people and too much gas. And he took off to the north, and we told him to take off to the south. And, well, he just didn't get over the trees.
Mm.
And pretty soon he's hitting the trees, and he crashed and tore the thing all up. And nobody died, but sure messed him up. And then some years later, there was a Navion, a twin Navion, with the small engines. They made two different, a twin Navion is a modification. The factory never made them with two engines.
Okay.
But two different companies modified the Navion and put two engines on it. One of them had 140 horse engines, and the other one had like 260 horse engines.
Okay.
And the one that crashed was the 140 horse engine.
Ah, okay.
And the guy was an obvious lowlander, and you know, didn't have any idea how to fly in the high country.
Okay.
And so he made the left turn. When it came to the mountain, he turned left. He didn't make it. Down he went.
Huh. And did he survive?
Yeah, everybody survived that one too.
Okay.
Of course, it tore the airplane all to pieces.
Right. Well, I think, I mean, this is juniper country. Those trees are pretty stout, and they're pretty thick. So you have to land down in there. It's going to be lots of firewood and a broken airplane.
Yeah. So there are some junipers up there, but it's mostly just pines.
Oh, okay. Pinyon pines?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know the area. You've been up there.
Well, I'd go back out and walk around and take another look, I think it sounds like here.
So have you been to the old airport?
I have, but not with the fortification you and your elder brother and your mom have given me, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And so everything would be under new eye management.
Yeah.
Looking for a whole different type of thing. Huh.
So, you know, I worked for the state. I worked for ADOT for 15 years, and then I worked for DPS as one of the governor pilots for 6 years. And so we had a flight up there, me and one of the other pilots. Well, we had lots of flights, but this one particular flight, we kind of flew over the airport on the way in, and then we were chit-chatting about it once we got there and said, well, let's borrow the crew car and just drive out there and I'll show you the place.
Okay.
So we did that, and we spent, several hours out there just walking around and driving around, and you know, every few feet, I'm telling them a new story about...
Oh, wow.
Whatever, you know, it was just a lot of fun.
Have you ever gone out there? Have you ever gone out there with a tape recorder and just walked around and recorded what you see and what you're thinking?
No, I never have done that.
Well, let's think about it.
Yeah, we could do that sometime.
Okay. Oh, that would be fun. Okay, so as a kid, you're fueling. What other chores did you have there in the summers?
Well, we sold tickets, we answered the phone, we took trash out, we did runway maintenance, like we would run a roller just to keep the runway smooth. We would throw big rocks off the runway, but that runway was used enough where it kind of maintained itself, unless there was some... heavy rains, and then the airplanes and the vehicles started making ruts on the runway.
Okay.
And then if it got real serious, then my uncle would get the road grader out.
Okay.
And blade it. But
did you guys have that, or did you borrow that from somebody?
No, we owned our own road grader.
Remember what kind it was?
It was a Caterpillar.
Okay.
And sometimes we would blade it and roll it at the same time. Other times we would just roll it with that that international tractor.
Okay.
We also had a 1914 Holt. So a 1914 Holt was the predecessor to Caterpillar.
Okay.
And Holt was the company that made the first tanks.
Okay.
In World War I. They were based on that tractor design.
All right.
And we used that we rarely used it because we didn't have that much use for it, but for really heavy maintenance kind of stuff, we would use it.
Okay. I'm thinking of a you know, D7 or D6 sized.
I don't know Caterpillars that well to know what a D6 or 7 is, but it was a fairly large tractor.
And it would clank along, clank 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 clank.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. As the big metal pads would rotate around through the drive gear and then off to the front and.
Right.
Okay.
And it was no electric, it was all hand start.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And hand operated, the brakes, the steering, which is just brakes, the clutch, all that It's all manual.
All right.
I had a magneto for the ignition. I had little primer cups where you'd open them up, and it had a thimble-sized little container that you'd put gasoline and open and let that down into the cylinders, and that would prime it, and then you'd get out there and start cranking on this thing.
Huh.
And eventually you'd get it running, and off you'd go.
Was it diesel or was it gas?
It was gas.
Okay. All right, so you had the International Harvester and then the Holt. What other vehicles did you have out there?
We had a couple of early 50s Chevy and GMC pickups.
Okay.
And then we had, it was an older, and I don't even remember what kind it was, but maybe late 30s pickup. And then we had a bunch of cars that we used as rental cars. Like I mentioned, we had that Morris Minor, which we used as a rental car.
Okay.
And then we had a Studebaker Lark and a couple of Mercury Comets. And I guess that was it for the airport vehicles. And then we had, of course, we had our own vehicle.
So somebody would fly in and then rent a vehicle to go see the canyon?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we'd have, three or five rental cars.
Okay. And there weren't any rental cars at the South Rim, per se. You guys must have been like the nearest car rental place.
Oh, I'm sure we were, yeah.
Huh. All right.
So if we ran out of rental cars, you know, and the tourists wanted to go up to the rim, we'd have to call Fred Harvey, and they would send out a taxi.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. All right. So the phone line, I think Doug was saying, and your mom, that the phone line came in after the TWA V United wreck in June of 1956.
Yeah.
Is that your recollection of that?
I'm not sure about that timeline. I think...
Yeah, you would have been four, too.
The phone was in earlier than that because, maybe not. I do know that we had to drive up into town to make the phone call to the airlines and tell them that we spotted the accident, the wreck.
That's what your mom said. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you remember about doing the maintenance on that phone line? Did you get into that?
Yeah, I did. In fact, I still have some of the equipment
that
we used in that. Yeah. So, but you know, the antique phones, they were all mounted on the wall, and you had to crank them to get them to ring. They had a little magneto in there and all like that.
Yeah.
So that's what our test equipment was. In fact, we had a phone, one of those old crank phones, in the hangar.
Okay.
And then we had one up at each one of the houses, too. So we were still using those crank phones when we were there.
Okay.
But the deal with that that phone line, and when Mom says they had to go into town, that doesn't necessarily mean that the phone wasn't in place.
Oh.
It may mean it was not in service because it was that time of the year, thunderstorm season. And the phone line was very fragile.
Okay.
Because the wire attracted lightning.
Ooh.
And if the lightning hit it, it just burned it.
Right. Oh, gosh. It would melt it. Or vaporize it.
Well, it usually just cut it in two.
Okay.
So what we would do is our phone line went from the hangar up to Tucson, which where the ranger station up there.
Okay.
And then we were on the public line from there on up. So it seemed like any time there was like a lightning storm, or sometimes even just animals, because a lot of the phone line was just laid on the ground. A lot of it was on top of fences, a lot of it was in the trees, and a lot of it was on the ground.
Okay.
And so it was kind of my job to fix that phone, but before they gave me all the responsibility, Uncle Walt and I would, you know, the phone would be dead. And so we'd start at the hangar, and we'd just walk the line until we find a break. And then we would use that little test phone, that little hand crank test phone.
Yeah.
And we would call the hangar, and if it rang and they answered it, we'd know that from where we were to the hangar was good.
Okay.
And then we'd call the ranger station, and if they didn't answer, we'd keep on walking.
You might have to walk a long ways to get to that break.
Yeah, stinking long ways.
Wow.
Yeah. And so we'd take a lot of water and a lot of lunch and, you know, a lot of wire and the tools and the splicing things and all that, and off we go.
Okay.
And it may take us all stinking day long. Sometimes
yeah.
It would take multiple days.
Wow.
And you know, we just have to come back, or, you know, we'd start at the hangar, so we always knew that the phone would work from where we were back to the hangar.
Okay.
And we could call them up and say, hey, you know, come get us, or bring us some more wire, or bring us some more food or water or whatever we needed. But, yeah, it was, and there could be numerous breaks.
Hmm. Oh.
In the line.
Okay.
Well, that was kind of fun. It was, you know, love-hate relationship.
Yeah, yeah. And then would people call in and say, hey, I'd like to go flying. What are your rates? How do I get there? Or I know how to get there. Okay, I'll be over there and, you know, for the 2 o'clock flight or something like that.
Yeah, we never did have a schedule.
Okay.
We just, the people would come out and we'd put them on a list, and then we'd get to them when we got to them.
Okay. So first come, first serve.
Yeah.
All right. Lewis, we've been visiting for about an hour now. I wonder if this is a good place to put a comma in this oral history interview series.
Okay.
Is there anything else in the material we have covered that you want to bring in before we take a break?
Nothing comes to mind.
Okay. Well, with that, let's conclude part two of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Lewis Hudgen. Today is Tuesday, August 20th, 2024. My name is Tom Martin, and Lewis, thank you so very much.
You bet.